From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are stepping up efforts to keep struggling homeowners out of foreclosure. And the Republican Governors Association meeting begins today. Former vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin says if her country needs her for higher office, she's still in the game. Here to break it down, we've got Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hi, guys.
Hi, Farai.
Hey, Farai.
Wow, I just, there's so much to keep track of.
I thought things were supposed to slow down after the election.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. The bailout plans, they just keep coming.
And they keep changing.
So, okay, you know, Mary, let me start with you. The Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, says he's changing this $700 billion financial industry bailout plan, shifting away from a plan to buy mortgage assets that plunged in value, taking a look at how to get consumer credit flowing. What does that really mean on a practical level, both for government and for, you know, real people?
Well, what it means is that first they figured out that trying to buy asset-based mortgages and figuring out how to price them and all that was too complicated, and it really wasn't doing anything to get any credit out there to people. And secondly, going to now help to bail out the credit card companies and the auto loan companies is helpful to people who have loans and who have credit card loans. But the arguments for not going to other sectors of the economy seem to grow more and more irrational as we go to different sectors. And the question is, how many sectors are we going to with this bailout, and how do some people get covered and others not? And if Mr. Paulson wasn't even sure that what he did so far would work and it didn't, how do we know that this will work?
Well, I mean, this is getting plain nuts, frankly. I personally
I was trying to be polite, Robert.
That's why you've got a Republican on here, so you don't have to be polite. The fact is, I was nominally supportive of the bailout because of the, when I say the bailout, of the $700 billion one, not as opposed to the 80/123/150 billion dollar AIG bailout, all the other ones, but I was nominally supportive of the $700 billion one because it was very, very clear that you were having this credit crunch and it was spilling over into the general economy and so forth. But I mean, in any other circumstances, this would look like a bait and switch where the guy says, "Oh, you know, please give me this money because I'm going to need to use it for X," and then it suddenly turns around and then uses it for Y, and then. Again, you also have all of these, as Murray said, you have all of these people basically lining up for their handout. You've got American Express, which reconsolidated as a banking investment company, and they'll say, "Oh, well, we need some money as well." I mean, it sounds a little bit extreme to say this, but you really are running into a direction of practically, you know, nationalizing just about every major industry in the country,
and I think. With that, Robert, a crisis of confidence is what we still have. Yeah. Because no matter what they do, the essential problem is that credit has not begun to flow and seems to be frozen. No one is really sure when this is all going to end or how far it's going to go. And people who have money are sitting on it. And when institutions get money and organizations, now credit card companies, before that banks, they want to sit on some of it because they want to see how this is all going to play out. So Paulson hasn't found the magic bullet to make anybody do anything to free up credit.
Robert, I have to jump in because I want to make sure that we get to the whole question
of
mortgages.
All right.
You know, because, you know, there's this kind of big umbrella of what's happening in all these different bailouts and with the financial companies. But now there's a specific issue on the table. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced they would adjust home loans so that more people in trouble can stay in their homes. And the details, again, are developing. But we're talking about something that looks like people who were more than 90 days late on their loan payments would get adjusted mortgages having to do with interest rates. Now, first of all, Mary, this only applies to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Is that enough?
No, it's not enough. Housing advocates immediately said it was not enough. because it's a step forward and it's different from what was going on before. But in the first place, why 90 days? And if you have 80 days, you know, why not? And should you wait until you have 90 days? And secondly, the idea was that when your mortgage was renegotiated, it would be something like 30-something percent of your, no more than 30-something percent of your income would be what they would charge you for the new mortgage. And the question was, how is that all calculated? And what about people who don't have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, mortgages? So that what it did was made people heartened at first, and then they started figuring out the details and then saying, okay, now who doesn't this cover? And how is this going to work?
Well, Robert, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup are all saying that they'll play ball along roughly the same lines. Is that enough? Or what does, more than is that enough, what will it take to give homeowners a stake in a recovery?
The easy answer is I don't know, and I don't think any of us really know. In a sense, all of the partisan or ideological rules have been kind of thrown out the window, because this crisis has gotten us to a situation where Republicans are becoming in favor of socialism and Democrats are becoming in favor of corporate welfare. And as a result, the people who are being sort of like left out on the side are indeed some of these people with these mortgages. Now, the free market or conservative Republican approach would be saying, well, you know, these are the people who should have known better, and just let them deal with it themselves. Unfortunately, we've gotten into a situation where those bad mortgages are having a ripple effect across the entire housing industry, causing even those people who have actually played by the rules, have made their payments on time, their housing values have also started to fall. In many cases, have fallen below the equity that they have in their within their houses. So people who've been doing the right thing are also getting harmed. So. I'm saying that we do need to find a solution where if the other banks are going to be following Fannie and Freddie into this and helping them out, we need to do it. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot
I've got to move us on to another topic. I know there's just so much news, and this really we only got a couple minutes to talk about.
Palin.
But yes, Sarah Palin. There's the Republican Governors Association meeting beginning today. I'm going to ask you about that in a second, Robert. But first, Sarah Palin, she's going on a media tour to basically recover her legacy. Fox's Greta Van Susteren asked her about the rumor that she didn't know Africa was a continent and not a country. Here's part of her response.
We discussed what was going on in Africa, and never, ever did I talk about, well, gee, is it a country or is it a continent? I just don't know about this issue. So I don't know how they took our one discussion on Africa and turned that into what they turned it into.
Do you think stuff like this helps her out, Mary?
I think that what Sarah Palin is doing now is she's free at last of the campaign. she's going out now to try to repair her image. And then after that, and she will start a sort of charm offensive after she does that to ready herself for additional leadership. If she doesn't say anything else really silly, and she manages to get by with some of that, maybe it will decline. But I think that the intellectuals within the Republican Party are so upset at the idea of somebody like her, who seems to them to have no ideas and to be crassly anti-intellectual, leading the party, means that she still will continue to be attacked, and they will try to keep her submerged.
Robert, there's also this Republican Governors Association meeting that starts today in Miami. You've got Governor Palin, you've got Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, Charlie Crist of Florida, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, all who have some different degree of high profile. We don't have time to go through each of them, but what roles do you see? Do you see any one of these guys or women taking a top spot in Republican leadership or being a 2012 candidate?
Without question. I would say Pawlenty, Mitch Daniels from Indiana, and Bobby Jindal are probably the top three. Sarah Palin is definitely going to be a factor. I think actually the McCain people were rather stupid to the McCain associates who were like attacking her and leaking about this stuff about her were rather foolish, because that actually enabled her to get another platform and talk a little bit more about herself and make herself more prominent. Jindal, though, I think is definitely going to be the person people will be looking at. He's younger. He happens to be, you know, a person of color with a funny name to go against the person of color with a funny name against the Democrats. You know, look, if I can, pardon the expression, call a spade here. But I mean,
letters.
Exactly. But those are going to be. But the thing is, Jindal is also somebody who has also studied healthcare as an issue as well. So he's somebody who's got like great ideas to actually move the Republican Party and the conservative movement forward. Okay. So those are the names you're going to be
hearing. And it depends on what happens in Louisiana and how successful he is with all the recovery stuff there. That this will sort of burnish his image if he can do that.
All right, and Mary, really, really quickly, Michael Steele, do you think he has a chance, African-American former lieutenant governor of Maryland, to lead the whole Republican Party?
I think he has a chance. I think the other people that you named are sort of out ahead of him. They wouldn't want to replicate exactly what the Democrats did, and I think Jindal has more of a shot than he does, but I think he has a shot.
But in terms of Steele as RNC chair instead of 2012, absolutely, I think Steele would be perfect in that position, actually.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We were talking with Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and she was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., plus Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and he was with us at our NPR studios in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Senator Barack Obama visits the White House. Governor Sarah Palin and her former running mate open up in interviews. And as protesters take to the street to battle the new ban on gay marriage in California, are Black Americans bearing the brunt of the anger? On today's Bloggers Roundtable, we've got self-described vigilante pundit Baratundi Thurston. He blogs for sites including The Huffington Post, Brandon Whitney, who runs the blog Homeland Colors, and Issa Yulin, the author of the novel Crystal Morning, who blogs at IssaYulin.com. Hi, guys.
How are you?
Hey, Farai.
So, there's plenty of news. First of all, you had President George Bush showing President-elect Obama around the White House, you know, measuring some curtains, all that. Baratundi, did this photo op / tour help President Bush reenter the spotlight for a second? Because we haven't seen much of him.
I think we haven't seen much of him by design, and it's probably to his own benefit not to be seen too much. He's going to leave with lower approval ratings than Nixon, which is quite an achievement for a guy who had two terms in office. That meeting, to say the least, must have been very awkward.
Issa, do you think it was awkward, and not just in that meeting, but also the position where you have the transition, one of the first things that happened was that President-elect Obama started getting certain classified security information about threats to the United States. And so there's this kind of sunsetting process for one administration and this ramp up for another. How do you think it's going to go this time around? Because there is such a lack of enthusiasm for the current president.
I think that, you know, George is done and he feels like his term is over and he's counting down the moments for his departure. He's a lame duck president at this point. But I think deep down he's actually got some regard for Obama and is certainly going to, you know, do his best to make the process smooth. Was it awkward? I mean, these two have met before. They're seasoned politicians. If nothing else, his respect for Obama will have him get past any awkwardness. And they'll handle the task at hand and then say, you know, part and say their goodbyes. And George Bush will go on to hunt and jog in Crawford, Texas.
All right, Brandon, speaking of hunting and handguns and, well, of guns, not just handguns, there has been an interesting trend, and Allison Keyes at NPR did a fantastic piece this weekend on it, of enormous amounts of gun sales sort of in this transition period. Some buyers think that it might be more difficult to get certain types of guns after Senator Obama takes office, even some of the Obama supporters. But, you know, what's the significance? Is this something that's racially tinged? Is it purely about politics and the fact that Senator Obama is likely to put more restrictions or advocate for more restrictions? What's going on here?
To me, it's just purely political. And I wouldn't even say that there's an effort at this point to scare people. I think that effort has already been made. Traditionally, organizations like the NRA and Republicans in certain areas, usually the South, scare people into voting against their own interests. So in order to get people to vote against Obama, who was probably supporting a lot of their economic interests, they said, he's going to take away your guns. Or they distract them with abortion, or they distract them with all of these different issues that don't really affect their lives on a daily basis, so that they vote against their interests. So it was basically just another part of that machine that existed before this election, and probably still does, that distracts people from their real issues. And that's just a part of it. So they're buying guns because they're afraid that Obama's going to take them away, and he's not. There are so many other more important issues for him to focus on than whether or not someone in the rural South can own a firearm or not.
Well, Baratunde, there was that moment, and Senator Obama sort of went back and forth over whether he should apologize or how he should treat it, where he talked about people clinging to guns and God because they felt fearful. And so is there going to be some kind of a culture shift around gun ownership that is actually going to affect people, whether or not they want a handgun for protection or whether they're sports hunters or whether they just like guns, as some people do?
I think what is what would be concerning is if the attitude and atmosphere of fear itself ramps up. We've come out of 8 years of fear-mongering around otherness, around terrorism, around people taking away what's yours as far as certain cultural rights. What Obama has promised and what hopefully he'll be able to do is kind of keep us more aspirational and away from fear. There's something actually frightening about scared people buying up a bunch of guns, and it's not something we need when we're diving into perhaps the worst economic situation in 100 years. Those are the things that I worry about, and I think he can, if anyone could, set a tone where that fear isn't acted upon through, you know, massive action and purchase of arms.
And I don't think this is Obama's burden to bear. I think this kind of goes into what the Democrats, and I would say the American people as a whole, need to do, and that is communicate with people who, and it was an accurate statement when Obama said, people are bitter, and they are angry, but they're angry at the wrong things. They're angry at the wrong people. If you live in a rural South, odds are, statistically, that you're less well off than people up north, or at least in the blue areas. And the reason for that is because corporate America has been taking advantage of these people. And rather than focus on corporate America, they focus on these non-issues. And it's not Obama's fault. I think it's our fault as progressives not communicating what the real problems and what the real sources of these problems are for the folks in these areas.
All right, Issa, I want to help transition us to another topic. And this is one that really has divided people across the country, even though it technically only applies in California. When voters went to the polls in California, the ballot included a referendum on gay marriage. Now, unlike other states where gay marriage bans passed, California had an active legal system where gays and lesbians could marry. And we saw a lot of people marrying right before Election Day just so they could know that they could do it. Now, these initiatives also passed in Arizona and Florida, but the issue there was much more theoretical. And you have a situation now where the New York Times, among others, has reported 70% of black folks in California voted for Proposition 8, which was for the ban, slightly more than half of Latinos, and also around half of whites. Some people are blaming Latino and African-American voters for the passage. What do you think about how this conversation has unfolded? What have you noticed, Issa?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that groups that could use opportunities and common histories, common struggles to form coalitions and work together, those opportunities are being squandered. It's not that different from the idea that, you know, lower-income whites vote against their economic interests when they are persuaded by the rhetoric of, you know, God and guns and abortion and all of that. I think what's interesting, however, is that as more and more members of Generation Y and younger people come of age and are able to vote, that these kinds of bans are going to be knocked down, and that civil unions or gay marriages are certainly going to be legalized in this country. I see that happening very soon. Gen Y has such a very different take on sexuality and sexual orientation than even Gen Xers and certainly baby boomers. The fluidity with which they define themselves and their relationships with men and or women is sometimes quite stunning to me, to be quite honest. But it's something that's very real that's coming out of their generation. And just as they've been the beneficiaries of the feminist movement and the civil rights movement, they're going to set a new tone for this discourse in the future. It's unfortunate that there's so much homophobia within our community, the African American community, that people are unable to see gay rights and the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community as one that has actually shared interests with us. As shared members. And I think the fault really lies on both sides.
All right. Well, I want to make sure that anyone just tuning in knows who we are speaking with on today's Bloggers Roundtable. This, of course, is NPR's News and Notes. And we were just hearing from Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. We've also got Baratunde Thurston, who blogs for sites including The Huffington Post and Brandon Whitney of Homeland Colors. We're talking about tensions between African Americans and the gay and lesbian community that have started with Proposition 8, but may not end there. I mean, in Baratunde, what struck me is that on our blog News and Views, this has been getting some of the largest number of responses. And people are angry, I would say on both sides, but there's never two sides to an issue. Some black people are mad, we're being scapegoated. Some gays and lesbians are mad, black people get it together. Some people are like, why didn't you go into black communities and,
That's a big point.
And go ahead.
We've been having Jack and Jill politics is sort of the primary place where I've put thoughts, and we've had a huge, probably record-breaking set of conversations and commentary from all sides around this. A couple of things have become very clear. One, the people who were kind of for the yes vote were extraordinarily well-organized, well-financed, and took nothing for granted. The people on the no side did the opposite of that in almost every possible way. And it seemed like there was an assumption made that California is a big blue state. We got this. And when it turned out that that wasn't the case, it was very much too late in the game to do any sort of actual cross-cultural, cross-urban outreach. And that assumption proved dreadfully false. The scapegoating charge is true. If you look at the actual numbers, my left wing, a blogger named Shanika, did some great math on how mathematically it's not possible, reasonable, or sane to sort of blame black people alone for this failure. Most importantly, we had one of our commenters, Michelle, who really, I think, nailed it when she talked about the era of the us versus them politics is not as effective as it had been before. And she had learned a lot from watching how Obama himself dealt with some of these situations, trying to cast these as universal all of us themes and not just gay, quote unquote, versus black, because that dynamic itself is a very unhealthy place to start a conversation.
And you know, I mean, I think the question as to whether or not blacks were the deciding factor in this vote is unimportant. I think the important question is, how homophobic is our community? And I think if we're very honest about it, we're pretty homophobic. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, which is a mostly black area, and it never occurred to me until I actually got a chance to interact with people who are homosexual, how much homophobia affects their lives. So I think we really need to get to the root of it and bring it out into the open. We have a lot of Pharisees, I would like to say, people who use religion as an excuse to be bigots. And if we're going to get further as a people, we got our black president. We need to actually become the kind of people we needed during the civil rights movement, who were people who saw something wrong happening that wouldn't necessarily affect them and acted. And right now we feel as if we've gotten over and we've forgotten that there are people who are suffering just as we suffered. I mean, I don't know if it'll take two gay people jumping over a broom for us to really get it. But it's important that we recognize people's rights are being violated. And just like some Jews came down south because they recognized a parity during the civil rights movement to what they went through in the Holocaust, we need to recognize the similarities between us and a homosexual movement and do something.
Issa, who's going to build the bridge?
I think the youth are. Yeah. I really do. I think that there's been a lot of division and fighting back and forth, and members of the gay lesbian community want to blame black folk, and black folk don't want to hear anything from the gay lesbian community. And I think that young people are thinking about race differently. They're thinking about gender differently. The only thing that seems to be really firmly in place is class for them. The class differences seem to be quite rigid. But these other dividers that have persisted for the past 400 years or so are really starting to disappear for younger people. And I think they're going to be the ones to really instruct the elders within both movements on both sides of the divide on how to shift the discourse forward and really come together. I love that point about African Americans being the people that we needed during civil rights and black power. I think that's right on the nose. And that's a good way to start that conversation.
Baratunde, I want to quickly transition to something that actually is connected to this. Roll with me here. We're talking about Senator John McCain and Governor Sarah Palin, his former running mate. And both of them have been talking to the media, but McCain went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno to say that he really does not blame Sarah Palin for his loss.
I'm so proud of her, and I'm very grateful that she agreed to run with me. She inspired people. She still does. And look, I couldn't be happier with Sarah Palin, and she's going back to be a great governor, and I think she will play a big role in the future of this country.
Baratunde, one of the big questions that came up and that's still coming up in the kind of postmortem of the election is, do Republicans want a social conservative like Sarah Palin, who has much more her views on issues like abortion and gay rights are much more to the right? She's a social conservative. What have we learned about the Republican Party? Is Sarah Palin more like the future of the Republican Party, or is John McCain more like the future of the Republican Party?
I think what we learned is that the future of the Republican Party is completely up for grabs and uncertain right now. This party had successfully combined in some magical way neoconservative military aggressors with fiscal conservative, in theory at least, and on paper many people, and social conservatives. And that coalition wasn't a natural one. It took years of nurturing and cajoling and influence. And it completely shattered under the weight of 8 years of George W. Bush and the rise of a pretty impressive political figure in the form of Barack Obama, plus some networked internet technology. So I don't think it's clear that McCain's the future or past or Palin's the future or past. I think that party's got a lot of inner searching to do to figure out just what it is it stands for and how it can coherently present that again.
All right.
I miss Lincoln's Republican Party. I want them to go back to the radical Republican roots where they weren't playing whites against blacks to get elected, which is basically, to be honest with you, been their strategy for the last 25 years. So I would love to see a Republican Party that I wouldn't lose sleep voting for. I mean, I've been a lifelong Democrat, but it would be nice to when they win, not freak out because I'm afraid my country's going to be destroyed.
Issa, just quickly, do you think Sarah Palin will be a factor in 2012?
Oh, God, I hope not.
All right. Well, that's a quick answer.
Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Cosign.
All right. Issa Yulin is the author of the novel Crystal Morning. She blogs at issayulin.com. Baratunde Thurston blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics. He was at our NPR New York studios. Brandon Whitney blogs at Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. America used to be the land of the one-drop rule. It meant if you had one drop of black blood, even if you looked white, you were considered black. It helped perpetuate the system of slavery, among other things. But the one-drop rule also helped shape pre-civil rights black communities where some people were clearly of mixed heritage, but no one called them biracial, even if they had a white parent. Well, things have changed. Today, America has a president-elect who some people call black, some people call biracial, and some people don't know how to label. But do the labels really matter? And why? And how has the entire conversation over multiracial identity shaped culture and politics? We'll start off our conversation today with Lisa Funderburg. Her book, Black, White, Other, was published in 1994, a time when multiracial identity was entering the public debate. She joins us now to help put this dialogue in a historic perspective. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Farai.
So when did the one-drop rule start to erode, and when did people consciously become biracial or multiracial in the way they define themselves?
Well, I think that the start of a real public biracial identity came with the baby boom. That was the first generation to profit in terms of attitudes and experiences from the burgeoning civil rights movement, from the increasingly legal recognition of their parents' unions as states overturned the anti-miscegenation laws, and then also from other factors such as World War II vets coming home having seen a different way in which they could be received by the world.
Now, of course, people who are multiracial can be many different combinations,
right,
but
right.
Your book, Black, White, Other, really was a landmark book, and it collected the stories of 46 adult children of black-white unions. And there was a cultural moment where people were really, people who may not have been personally invested through their family histories were really looking at this issue, as well as people who did have mixed-race families that they came from. So what did you find in your research?
Well, I found that starting with the 1980s, there was a burst of biracial presence, acknowledged mixed race backgrounds in the marketplace and in various forms of culture. You know, maybe nothing did more for a public sense that there are mixed race people out there than A Different World, the spinoff from The Cosby Show that ran from 87 to 93. People like Jennifer Beals in Flashdance, Halle Berry in the 1990s, Lenny Kravitz, Lisa Bonet, those were all people who might have chosen to identify as black, but were not hiding the fact or ashamed of the fact that they had parents from the two different backgrounds.
I remember when I was in college, and that was now 20 years ago, but but there was a lot of discussion on campus about this, and there were some tough moments. Is it an easier time now for people to say, I'm biracial, without people perceiving it as them saying, I'm not black, which has been an issue that comes up again and again? Do you think that's a fair debate to have, whether some people are conflicted about race as well as, you know, trying to run away from something rather than trying to embrace something?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of the conflict between people who identified as mixed race, black, white, biracial, and black was that there was a perception that the mixed race people were trying to define themselves as the colored caste of South Africa, something slightly better and above, maybe closer to white, as if that were a positive value. And that was not well received by many people in the black community. I think what started to shift was that it has become, as I think President-elect Obama demonstrates, this can be an identity that is fluid, that is not denigrating any particular aspect of it, that is proud of all components of its heritage, and that has so much fluidity that Obama, for example, can identify as a black man and as a biracial person without canceling each other out.
You also you've written a new book, Pig Candy, which looked at your father's life in his last years. African-American, grew up in rural Georgia. Mm-hmm. How do you think he would perceive this moment in history where you do have a black biracial man who's going into the White House, but also these debates over identity?
Well, I think my father would have been thrilled, and a lot of that is informed by his particular background, which is mostly what I was trying to figure out, was who was my father as a man besides just being my father? What was his connection to American history? And he was deeply rooted in the Jim Crow South. He was part of the Great Migration of blacks from the South to the North. He was there pre-civil rights, whereas I was a civil rights baby. And I think he would have called Obama the Jackie Robinson of the White House, which was one of his highest forms of praise for anyone. So I think he would have been proud. And when I went in to vote on Election Day, I felt like he's since passed. I felt like he was with me. And that my grandfather, in fact, was with me, who had been registering voters in 1946 in rural Georgia, which was a perilous thing to do, black voters. And so I think my dad would have been excited and gratified about this new direction. But I also think that he would be glad to see discussions of race elevated, as he would say, from just an emotional level to a more pragmatic level. How can we use this information to advance causes that are important to people in the sort of core areas of their lives?
Well, Lisa, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks.
That was Lisa Funderburg, author of Black, White, Other, and most recently the memoir Pig Candy. She joined us from Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. And from Black, White, and Other to Check All Boxes That Apply, How the American Government Tracks Race Has Changed. Add that to the cultural debates and you've got a constant reevaluation of identity. Joining us to continue the conversation, we've got Relina Joseph, adjunct assistant professor in the Department of American Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies at the University of Washington, and Jongmiwa Bullock, the president of the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans. She's also a PhD candidate in American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Hi, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So, Jongmiwa, let me start with you. You heard Lisa Funderburg talk about this moment in history. Your organization is very much one where I don't think, maybe, you know, tell me if you disagree, it couldn't have existed half a century ago. It is something where identity has changed, or concepts of identity have changed. Do you think that the election of President Obama, the fact that you've got folks like Tiger Woods, means that we're in a better place racially with identity, or is it still difficult to try to discuss these intersections of personal identity?
Those are all great questions. I actually want to answer the first part of your question first, which was about, could an organization like AMIA, which is one of the oldest leading umbrella associations for multiracial families, individuals, and organizations, actually today marks the 20th anniversary of AMIA's founding. But one thing that I want to mention is that actually in 1892, there was actually a group called the Manasseh or the Manasseh Society that started in Wisconsin and Chicago, actually, which was an elite group of multiracial people that lasted for 40 years. If you notice on the 1890 census to the 1930 census, there actually was a strong, you'll see a shift in the census where black was differentiated from differentiated with mixed race sort of groupings. So you'll notice that there is a change. So I wanted to add that into the discussion. And that kind of gets to this question here is, now that we have President-elect Obama, you know, has a discussion changed? I do think that there was a missed opportunity during the elections to talk about, you know, multiracial identity in a different way than we have before. And by that I mean that, from the media's perspective, you know, he had been cloaked as a single race category, the first black president. But I think there was a missed opportunity while he was talking about his mixed race identity, but in a kind of, a colorblind sort of way. But I would say that there are what I call in my research, the politics of being multiracial, that are still at play. One thing that the previous guest was saying is that, you know, we're talking about black and white, but we do understand that people who are biracial or multiracial, a person like myself, I'm black and Asian. Now, what does it mean when white is not part of my binary? And how do I engage in that discussion? There are many people listening who might call themselves, you know, like Tiger Woods, Kablan Asian, or people who are Mexican and black. I mean, what does it mean to be two so-called minority populations that engage in this discussion where white is not part of the binary? And I think that should be brought into the conversation as well, because AMIA, we represent all these diversities. And I think that was what I meant by a missed opportunity, but it doesn't mean that we can't engage in this conversation from here forward.
Relina, do you think that there was a deliberate attempt to avoid this conversation? Because there have been so many conversations going on about race, and it's not as if the senator didn't deal with it at all. I also actually, let me go to a clip and have you respond to it. There was a moment in his first press conference as president-elect where he answered a question about the kind of dog the Obamas might adopt for their daughters.
There are a number of breeds that are hypoallergenic. On the other hand, our preference would be to get a shelter dog, but obviously A lot of shelter dogs are mutts like me.
So, Relina, first of all, what did you think of his comment? And secondly, did people avoid the topic of biracial identity on purpose?
Well, on a personal level, I just kind of smiled when I heard that comment. It was actually a little bit of a relief for me to hear Obama speak in a lighthearted way, on the one hand, because we don't see that side of him too often. And also for us to have this little peek into his own racialization. I think that, as Jemmy was alluding to, that many of us can read multiracial politics into the way in which he racializes himself. So, for example, we all know that he talks about his mother from Kansas and his father from Kenya, and then leaves it as that. He doesn't make an I am statement. But this kind of racialization by parental proxy lets so many different constituencies then read themselves into him. And I think is part of the formula that made him such a viable candidate.
Jing Miwa, you mentioned that there are a lot of people who are also, say, two identities of color in their family. And tell us about your impressions of how things have panned out on this whole idea of how you change racial classifications in the census. You mentioned something from a long time ago, and racial classifications have changed, but there was this significant change for the last decennial census that really changed from a, you know, kind of a pick one to a, you know, pick all that apply. What kind of ramifications have we seen since then of that change?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of mobilization in the 80s, and actually the people who preceded me, the late Ramona Douglas, the former president of AMIA as well. And what was happening is that there was a whole discussion happening all over the country that, you know, actually there are families that want to mark all that apply for their children. Because what does that mean? Although race is a social construction, right, that's why we see it changing on the census. At the same time, it becomes real on the ground level for people, right, how you identify. And so we noticed that there were many things happening. We thought if we helped to move and mobilize people to change that and to mark all that applied, first of all, we would engage in a discussion about race that hadn't happened. Second of all, we could actually speak to parents out there that are still, you know, having to deal with their own cultural competency when it comes to racially identifying their children, which has a profound effect. I think Relina probably could speak to this as well, that in the academy, it seems that a lot of times multiracial children, by the time they get to college, it's the first time they've actually feel like they can talk about their multiracial identity in a kind of more engaging and sophisticated way that sometimes, unfortunately, isn't happening in the household. And we thought that change in the census would initiate that. And it really has, but I think there's so much more work to do.
Well, Relina, what about downsides? Some people look at the approach that the census took and say, well, it actually is something that could undermine efforts at affirmative action. What right. do you think, Relina? I see Jung Miwa shaking her head, but I'll come back to you. But what do you think?
Well, that was the big debate, right, in the lead up to the 2000 census, was that all different types of ethnic advocacy groups, the NAACP, La Raza, a number of other groups, were really opposed to the development of this check all category because there was this fear that this multiracial group would actually usurp the resources. And I think that the interesting thing is that did not happen because although on the census one is allowed to check all, the way those numbers are tabulated is in all different types of ways. And so there are ways to figure out how many people are multiracial African American and still be able to maintain the integrity of African American numbers. I think that at the same time, I'm cautious of the exalting of a multiracial identity above all others, as opposed to having a type of fluid identity that Lisa Funderburg spoke about. So, for example, to be Black and to be mixed race, or to be Black and to have a mother from Kansas and a father from Kenya, because that doesn't necessarily mean that you're claiming a mixed race identity. So that's my one hesitation about, mm-hmm. I think, some of the directions that the multiracial movement has gone, is to really kind of uphold a multiracial identity above all others and to the exclusion of the type of multiplicity that's so important when we have communities that are still struggling.
Okay.
I have
to jump in because we're just about out of time. Jung Miwa, what should we look for ahead, either in terms of legal issues or cultural issues?
Okay. Actually, to say this really quick, and this might go back to the Mutt comment, I would say that if President-elect Obama is listening, I would say that in terms of the Mutt comment, it was wonderful. I think that you made a public announcement in, you know, kind of a, I guess, covert way of talking about it. But at the same time, I will say that you have a challenge here in the country, that Mutt is a derogatory term, and there are people who are looking up to you. And we would hope that we can engage in that discussion and be able to talk about it in a more sophisticated way from this point forward.
All right. Well, it looks like we're going to have a lot to talk about. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Jung Miwa Bullock, president of the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans. She joined us here at NPR West. And Relina Joseph, adjunct assistant professor in the Department of American Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies at the University of Washington from KUOW in Seattle. That is our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. You can visit us online at nprnewsandnotes.org. And News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.